This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Miami is nicknamed the Magic City, and that's where 20 presidential hopefuls found themselves this week, hoping to channel some of that magic for a win in 2020. After two nights of televised Democratic debates, where does a challenge to President Trump stand? Speaking of elections, the Supreme Court this week helped set the stage for next year with a ruling on partisan gerrymandering. And House Democrats ignore Robert Mueller's reluctance to appear before Congress and set a date for him to testify. It's the Friday News Roundup, when we look back at some of the biggest stories of the week and consider how they may shape the days ahead. Joining me in the studio is Cheryl Gay Stolberg. She's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Hello, Cheryl.
Hi.
Also with us is Lauren Barone Lopez. She's a national political reporter for Politico. Hi, Laura.
Great to be here.
And Edward Luce is the chief columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. He's also the author of The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Good to have you on, Ed.
Great to be here, Kimberly.
First to Miami. 10 candidates took the stage Wednesday night at the first Democratic debate, and 10 more stood up there last night. They covered issues such as health care, immigration, geopolitical threats, gun control, and generational divides?
I was 6 years old when a presidential candidate came to the California Democratic Convention and said, "It's time to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans." That candidate was then Senator Joe Biden. Joe Biden was right when he said it was time to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans 32 years ago. He's still right today. If we're going to solve the issues of automation, pass the torch. If we're going to solve the issues of climate chaos, pass the torch. If we're going to solve the issue of student loan debt, pass the torch. If we're going to end gun violence for families who are fearful of sending their kids to school, pass the torch.
Vice President, would you like to sing a torch song?
I would. I'm still holding on to that torch.
That was California Representative Eric Swalwell, one of the debate's moderators, Jose Diaz-Balart from Telemundo, and Vice President Biden. Cheryl, what were your big takeaways for both nights? Any big surprises?
Well, I think there were a couple of breakout stars, first of all. I think on the first night, Julian Castro was kind of a breakout star because people didn't really know that much about him. He really went after Beto O'Rourke on immigration and established himself as a voice, I think, for immigration reform. I think on the second night, you'd have to say Kamala Harris was the breakout star. She really took on Joe Biden over his comments about working with segregationists in a way that was really frustrating for him and left him kind of befuddled and without an adequate reply. And she also demonstrated herself to be very, very tough. I will also say on the first night, Elizabeth Warren also did very well, demonstrated herself to be very tough and clear. Her slogan, her mantra, "I have got a plan for that." She did have a plan for that for pretty much everything, including Mitch McConnell when she was asked. So those are my big takeaways.
Let's hear that exchange from last night between California Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Joe Biden.
I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden. I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
Joshua tweets, "Joe Biden trying to defend his stance on busing was a complete failure. You don't leave solutions to segregation to those who have a history of segregating. His idea of leaving it to local communities would do that." Laura, what was your take on that whole exchange?
Look, that was a strong, stunning exchange, one that Harris had clearly prepared for. We know that because not only did she look for the opening in the debate, she wasn't really handed it. She looked for an opening as soon as the candidate started talking about race. She jumped in. She said, look, I'm the only black woman up here. I should be able to talk about this. Then she artfully pivoted to say, now I want to talk about Biden's comments on segregation. They had T-shirts ready to go. They had a hashtag ready to go. They tweeted out the photo of her as a young little girl going to school shortly after the exchange. It did not look good for Biden. You have to wonder whether or not he was even prepared for that kind of attack, which he should have been given the events of the last few weeks, because that's what's dominated his comments, his segregation comments. A number of newspapers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, have done big dives into his past.
I wrote history. One this week.
Yeah, Cheryl did, of busing.
So, and his criminal justice reform.
So what did you think of his response, Cheryl? Or how did he respond?
I don't think he knew how to respond, and I don't think he did respond. He responded by saying it was a mischaracterization of his views. He has said that he did not want the federal government to run busing, that it should be left to localities, which is, frankly,
splitting hairs.
Right. Not only splitting hairs, but sort of harks back to the era of states' rights, which anybody who knows their history in this country knows that states' rights argument was used to enforce things like poll taxes to keep, you know, African Americans down. I just thought his response was inadequate. And then at the end, he said, well, I've run out of time. And
which,
frankly,
was really shocking.
It was really odd. Like, who cedes their time on a debate stage, especially in a debate where there are 10 candidates, everybody is grasping for time? He had the floor and he gave it up because he apparently didn't have anything to say.
You know, Edward, that leads to a comment that we got from one of our text club listeners who was watching last night. One wrote, these Democrats are angrier than Wednesday night's Democrats. And another texted, mute the mics, don't let people interrupt. There was a ton of crosstalk. What did you think of Wednesday night's lineup versus last night's?
They were two completely different debates. Wednesday was, you know, fairly civilized, quite low energy. There was only one really strong sort of candidate there, and that was Elizabeth Warren. I agree with Cheryl that Castro put in a good performance, but Thursday night was an extremely kinetic evening. I'd say it was no stage for old men. It was a really bad night for Biden and a really bad night also for Sanders, who sounded pretty stuck. As Laura and Cheryl pointed out, when Biden said, my time is up, that was sort of almost too good to be true. It did sort of summarize the whole attack on him. And this stuff about states' rights and busing cuts to the very core of the entire basis of Biden's candidacy, which is, let's go back to before Trump, when we knew how to work across the aisle. But if you're talking about, you know, going back 40 years, working with the likes of Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms, etc., who have segregationist backgrounds, Deep South backgrounds, then it leaves you a much, much narrower ground to stand on. And Biden's whole case is, look, I'm the common ground guy.
I would also say that this raises the central question for Democrats who are looking at Biden, which is, does Biden get it? Does he understand the feeling on the liberal base in this day and age, or does he want to go back to the good old days, which, frankly, candidates like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and others would argue were not that great? Who were the good old days good for? They were good for white men.
And it also strikes at the whole debate about what is the pathway to victory for Democrats. So Biden is arguing that it's through winning back those voters that went to Trump, you know, not really overtly talking about race, talking about how to lift all ships, really playing to voters in the Midwest. And then the candidates like Harris, Warren, and Booker are arguing, no, we need to expand our coalitions, energize our base, really very distinctly talk about black voters, Latino voters, and speak to them. And that's the only way we're going to beat Trump.
You all mentioned that Bernie Sanders didn't have the night many people expected that he would, but AC Monroe tweets, Bernie ran away with the debate, followed closely by Harris. Biden bombed, as did Pete. It was quite a spectacle. I look forward to the next one when we cut out some of the useless candidates from the roster. There is still quite the field of candidates left. Will the last two nights of debate help winnow that field at all, Laura?
Well, so the next debates are, I don't know if the field is going to winnow that much before the next debates or even after the next debates in July. But, you know, I disagree a little bit with the listener just because Sanders didn't really create an opportunity for himself to dominate news the way Harris did and the way Buttigieg did. They're the ones that are dominating news coverage the next few days.
Coming up, some Republican lawmakers are reckoning with a new rape allegation against President Trump. And what is the Hatch Act anyway? But first, today we're remembering a violent incident that took place on June 28, 1969. In the early morning hours, the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village was raided by New York police, an event that would lead to protests which helped spark the modern-day LGBTQ rights movement. On the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion, and as Pride Month comes to an end, we'll honor the civil rights successes of activists and allies with anthems from the movement. We asked you to tell us about songs that inspired you as activists and allies. El Medina NYC tweets, I first heard Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat on college radio station KUSF in San Francisco. I'd just come out when it was released in 1984. Although this is a dance song, the lyrics are about the isolation and loneliness of being different and gay. As a child, I related to the very British vocalist Jimmy Somerville's experiences. I guess these experiences are what bind the LGBTQ community worldwide. More with Ed Luce of the Financial Times, Politico's Laura Barrón-Lopez, and Cheryl Gray Stolberg of the New York Times is next. I'm Kimberly Adams of Marketplace, in for Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, a turning point in the movement for LGBTQ rights. So in this week's episode of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we'll revisit the very first documentary our founder, Dave Isay, made back in 1989, called Remembering Stonewall. Listen and subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams in for Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Ed Luce, chief columnist and commentator for the Financial Times, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and Politico national political reporter Laura Barrón-Lopez. And let's get back to the presidential debate, Democratic presidential debate from last night. And Edward, do you think anything was said either night that's really going to make or break the race for any particular candidate?
Look, I think the vulnerability of Biden and Sanders has been shown up, but the history of debate shows that we always overinterpret their impact, and that they very rarely change the nature of a race. I think, you know, just to sort of be contrarian about Kamala Harris's searing and highly memorable performance and probably devastatingly effective one, just to be contrarian, she did stick her hand up and say that she would get rid of private health insurance. And she also was one of the 10, all 10 stuck their hands up and said they would provide health care to undocumented immigrants. Good for the liberal base in a primary, great material for Trump in a general. And so, you know, we tend to look at these things in the immediacy of their aftermath. But as time goes on, there are viral moments we might not have anticipated.
We're going to get to the immigration questions a little bit later. But Cheryl, we talked about the debates yesterday on this program with a group of voters, and they disagreed about the importance of Democrats focusing their campaigns on beating Trump. Kate Knockhazel told us she would rather hear policy goals, but Paige Horace said being able to defeat Trump in 2020 is what truly matters for Democrat voters. What did you think of the focus or non-focus on the two nights on the president?
I was struck, frankly, by the absence of Trump in the debates, especially in the first night where there was really a lot of policy discussion. There was sort of down in the weeds discussion by Julian Castro about, you know, Section 1325, a 1929 law. And, you know, Warren kept coming forth with her plans. And then the second night, a lot of the focus was on attacking Biden. So it felt to me like this was really a fight among Democrats. It was an internal fight, and that the candidates had yet to look beyond the coming primary to the guy that they, one of them, is really going to have to beat.
Let's move on to immigration. Haunting photographs of a father and daughter drowned in the Rio Grande have rocked the U.S. and could have a critical impact here in Washington, D.C. The Guardian reports that Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez brought his 23-month-old daughter Valeria to the U.S. side of the river before jumping back in to get her mother. The toddler jumped in after him. He turned to rescue her, and both were swept away by the current. Laura, horrifying and tragic things like this, unfortunately, happen regularly to migrants. Why is this moment resonating as much as it is?
Because it was captured in a photograph, and it's also because it comes at a time when there's a lot of scrutiny on the detention centers for migrants. The one in Clint, Texas, has received heightened scrutiny because of the lack of standards for the migrants there. When the Democrats were down in Florida, and a lot of them have gone to the Homestead Detention Facility, which is a for-profit facility that houses migrant children. And Warren, when she visited the day before her debate, she said that when she was able to peek over, since none of them have been allowed in, even though they requested to tour the facilities, she said that, it looked like, you know, the children were little soldiers being marched, across between the buildings. So this has been getting a lot of attention in the debate. I just want to point out that in the first night, Julian Castro really shifted the field by bringing up the 1325 law, which is he supports the decriminalization of border crossings for migrants. So treating it as a civil as opposed to a criminal offense. And a lot of candidates have now come out and supported that, and he was the first to do that, and he called on all of them to do that. Warren supports it. The second night, I think 7 out of the 8 candidates on stage said that they support that as well. So he's been effective in pushing his fellow Democratic contenders.
Let's hear that clip of tape that you referenced. It was an exchange between Julian Castro and former Representative Beto O'Rourke on the immigration plan.
Let's be very clear. The reason that they're separating these little children from their families is that they're using Section 1325 of that act, which criminalizes coming across the border, to incarcerate the parents and then separate them. Some of us on this stage have called to end that section, to terminate it. Some, like Congressman O'Rourke, have not. And I want to challenge all of the candidates to do that. I just think it's a mistake, Bethel. I think it's a mistake. And I think that if you truly want to change the system, then we got to repeal that section. If not, then it might as well be the same policy.
Cheryl, that seemed to, as Laura mentioned, impact candidates' answers on last night's debate stage. Many said undocumented immigrants with no criminal record should not be deported, and all 10 on stage said they supported public health care for the same group. So how will some of these positions that they've laid out on immigration, do you think, shape the race moving forward?
Well, I think if Julian Castro accomplishes nothing in this race, he has accomplished putting this issue on the table for Democrats to discuss. And he has basically set the benchmark for what will be the Democratic position, which is that we should not criminalize crossings across the border, that they should be treated as civil matters. So, you know, going forward, I think we will see Democrats embracing that position increasingly. But I also think, as Ed mentioned, a lot of these positions are going to make great clips for Donald Trump when he runs for re-election. And he will clearly take another view. He'll talk about the laws of the United States. He'll talk about Democrats wanting, quote unquote, open borders, wanting to let everybody in.
If I could, they already, I mean, as soon as Castro made those comments on the debate stage, Trump's campaign manager fired out a tweet saying, oh my God, Democrats are for open borders, but that's not entirely accurate. I mean, it's not accurate. So what Castro's thing would do is, yes, it would repeal 1325, O'Rourke actually supports repealing part of 1325, specific to the asylum bit of it. But there are multiple other laws on the books that allow for border officials to criminally charge migrants if they're trying to enter between ports of entry, refer them to DOJ for those criminal charges. And as Castro tried to illustrate in what his response might be if he ever somehow faced Trump, which a lot of us don't expect him to be the nominee, but if he were to face Trump, he said that, look, that's a right-wing, quote, right-wing talking point. He also argued that there's no way we have open borders when we have some 600 miles of fencing, drones on the border, thousands of personnel. So that is how Democrats might respond to that attack.
More than 100 children, you were speaking of those migrant detention centers, more than 100 children have been returned to that border station in Clint, Texas, that attorneys said had substandard living condition. Immigration attorneys who have visited there reported that there weren't enough toothbrushes, toothpaste, or soap, children kept in filthy clothes or dirty diapers, many not bathing in weeks, their diet consisting of instant noodles and frozen burritos. Edward, the initial reports of what the attorneys have called inhumane conditions did come out about a week ago. What's happened since then, and why are these kids going back?
Well, they actually held a tour for reporters on Wednesday of the Clint site, the notorious site, in which reporters weren't allowed to interact with the children. They weren't allowed to roam unrestricted, and felt that they'd had the veil pulled over their eyes. So there's been a PR pushback by the CBP. But absolutely no evidence that the system has changed. And as you say, the ACLU and the union representing asylum officers is suing for inhumane conditions at these centers, of which there are many, many across the border area.
Why are those kids going back, though, Cheryl?
I don't think, frankly, we have a good answer for why those kids are going back. I think the administration perhaps would say, we have nowhere else to put them. But frankly, I think you raise a very good question.
Yeah.
Do any of my colleagues here have any idea
no.
why I think they're going
yeah.
back?
I don't think that we've received an answer from the administration on why that's happening. And this is also part of, you know, the larger debate. I'm not sure if we're about to talk about it, but with the Senate and House passing the emergency aid, the $4.6 billion in emergency aid, and Democrats were trying to get a provision in there that would have addressed the hygiene, the nutrition standards for these migrants. And Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the Senate didn't want that language added. And so House Democrats were kind of left with no options or nowhere to turn.
Right. Democrats in the Senate effectively threw House Democrats, especially liberal Democrats, under the bus. And we saw a rare defeat for Nancy Pelosi on this bill, which passed yesterday, $4.6 billion in aid for the border. Liberal Democrats are furious because they wanted a measure that would have imposed strict health and safety standards and also would have reduced some money for immigration, for ICE, and they didn't get that.
And President Trump is expected to sign that legislation.
Yes, he is. Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
what does it actually mean will change on the border and whenever he signs it?
Well, that they have more resources to address the humanitarian crisis on the border. And so Democrats are going to be keeping a close eye to where they spend that money, where ICE, CBP, DHS allocates that money. I don't think that it also made it into the final bill. And Cheryl may know this as well, which is they wanted more strict guardrails. So that way Congress wanted to be able to have a better enforcement mechanism so that way they could keep an eye on where the money was sent. So that way they could have some kind of like mechanism to pretty much force the administration to send money to certain directions.
And funding has been an issue on the border this week. The acting head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection resigned in the wake of everything that's been happening. John Sanders told employees that he would leave on July 5th. He didn't give a reason, but CBP has been complaining for some time about the funding issue. Edward, do we have any sense of what's going on at Customs and Border Protection and why Sanders may have left at this particular juncture?
Well, you can guess at why he might have left. I mean, he left that silent, as you pointed out. I imagine the strain on that agency just gets more and more acute. I imagine the debates within it for being held responsible for what are horrendous, horrific pictures and depictions of some of the detention facilities that they're running makes it a harder and harder job to do. He didn't say any of this, though, but we can read between the lines. There is a funding question that has partially been resolved for the time being, this $4.6 billion bill that Laura outlined. But it hasn't addressed, as she pointed out, some of the restrictions that most people who've been watching this, but particularly Liberal Democrats, believe should be in place to ensure that they're run in a humane way.
So, you know, although he didn't say why he left, I was very, very struck by Sanders' resignation letter to his staff, in which he talked in a very emotional way about the mission. And he said, "What I didn't appreciate at the time was how the journey would transform me professionally and personally." He was talking about his journey within the agency. And at the very end, he said to them, "Take care of each other." And it was almost like he was saying, we have this awful task and it's overwhelming. And I recognize that, you know, all of you are struggling with this. And he seemed to me to be saying that he was really struggling, too.
And not the only one. The union that represents U.S. asylum officers is actually urging a federal appeals court to block the Trump administration's so-called Remain in Mexico policy. The rule forces migrants to wait in Mexico while their asylum case makes its way through the immigration court, a process that often takes years to complete. The union argues that the practice is, quote, fundamentally contrary to the moral fabric of our nation, relating to that strain that many of these agencies are under. Laura, are you familiar with the status of this case and what's going on there?
I'm not with that case, but relatedly, you know, speaking to the strain that all these agencies are under, that the judges are under, is that there's a backlog of some 900,000 cases for migrants who have not had their hearings, who have not had their day in court. I think late last year, it reached nearly a million. And so that's something that a number of immigration experts have told me that they think candidates should be addressing more, that they should be talking about how they would actually streamline processes like that in order to make coming over less difficult.
Just this case that they, and in concert with the ACLU, are bringing against the administration, I think speaks to the larger question you asked about the Customs and Border Patrol. It's that they are the ones being forced to take the strain of a very, very difficult policy. In this case, the Remain in Mexico policy is sending asylum seekers back to the country that they're seeking to flee, which of course contravenes every basic principle of asylum in international law. And they cite, going back to the Pilgrim Fathers, I believe, they cite, look, how could America have worked if this principle had been in place? And I guess it's a rhetorical question. Because to them, taking the strain of breaking what they believe is a moral law, it results in only one answer. This is not in keeping with humanitarian refugee.
Right, that's exactly what they were saying in the suit. They are saying that, in effect, the president's policies are compelling them to engage in, quote, the widespread violation of international and federal law, and that this is not something that they signed up to do when they, you know, signed on to work for the United States government.
Before we move on, one more immigration story that broke today. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear President Trump's bid to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program, better known as DACA. And just ahead, Robert Mueller says he laid out everything he has to say in his report. So what more are House Democrats hoping he'll say during public testimony next month? And today, we're honoring the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion with anthems from the LGBTQ rights movement, selected by you. Paul tweeted about I Know a Place by Muna, saying it came on Spotify when I was cleaning one day. And as an ally, this plays like both a rally cry and a reminder that safe spaces can exist among all the hate. And it's just also a banger. More on the roundup in a moment. Stay close.
I know a place we can go. Yeah. For everyone,
Support also comes from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. So you're listening to this NPR podcast because you want to be informed. You want to learn something. But what if you need a little break? Well, then you want to check out Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. It's the show that lets your lizard brain enjoy itself for once. You can be serious again later. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's discuss a few more of the stories of the week on the Friday News Roundup. My guests are Laura Barrón-López, national political reporter for Politico, New York Times Washington correspondent Cheryl Gay Stolberg, and Ed Luce, chief columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. Cheryl, let's move to the Trump administration. Over the last week or so, President Trump backed off a strike against Iran. He also tweeted promising mass deportations by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in cities across the United States, and then he said he planned to postpone those for 2 weeks. What rationale did he give for backtracking on both of these actions?
You know, I think this is a theme, actually, with President Trump, and this is not the first time we've seen him sort of come up to the edge of doing something and then backtrack. You might remember when he was threatening tariffs with Mexico, and he kept saying, I'm going to impose these tariffs if they don't do anything. And he went sort of right up to the line. And then at the last minute, he pulled back and said, oh, well, we've got this agreement, which actually was an agreement that they had already reached months ago. And it made me think about like Teddy Roosevelt, who used to say, speak softly and carry a big stick. And I think Donald Trump speaks loudly and carries a little stick. His whole plan seems to be to try to push people into action by threatening, and then at the last minute, he backs off.
Well, and in this case, he was able to successfully this week push the Democrats to pass that immigration legislation.
The thing about his backtracking, though, is you never really know how long it's going to last. And in both these cases, his deadline for the Democrats closing alleged loopholes in immigration laws and changing America's asylum laws, and also on Iran, both of them, we've got another roughly 10 days. Iran has said on July the 7th it will start to breach the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement, by enriching more uranium. That's going to be a trigger for the hawks around Trump, and it's undoubtedly going to raise tension. And the 2 weeks that Trump said he would give Nancy Pelosi as a sort of stay of execution of targeting undocumented immigrants for deportation, millions of them, that will elapse at roughly the same time. So how long he backtracks for, I mean, I think Cheryl has a wonderful, the big stick speak softly thing, or the reverse of that, summarizes him a lot of the time, but not all of the time.
And also I would just say that I think it's a little bit of a mischaracterization to say that Trump pushed Democrats and Congress to get this immigration bill passed. I mean, Senate Republicans and Democrats like worked on this together, and they're the ones that really set the tone for it. And then they battled the House a bit on it. But House Democrats were able, Pelosi was able to get some concessions out of Trump, out of the administration. And one of those was that Congress needs to be notified within 24 hours of the death of a migrant in U.S. custody.
Are there consequences for this pattern of backing off?
I mean, it seems as though there isn't, at least when it comes to the party and Republicans. They don't criticize Trump. Republicans have very much become the party of Trump. And so you might see little comments from Republican senators or House members saying, oh, I wouldn't quite say something that way, or I wouldn't have, you know, approached Iran in that way. I don't think we can deport millions of immigrants. They'll say little light things like that. But when push comes to shove, they fall in line.
I think over time, the question is, will there be consequences if this really emerges as a pattern, especially overseas with his relations with international leaders who will know not to take him at his word?
That helps us move very quickly over to this week, the fact that Trump is in Japan with G20. And this week, President Trump's chief of protocol, Sean Lawler, said he planned to quit and would not join the president at the G20 meetings in Japan. Lawler is departing, quote, amid a possible inspector general's probe into accusations of intimidating staff and carrying a whip in the office, end quote, according to Bloomberg, which spoke to a person familiar with the matter. What role did Lawler play within the Trump administration? And, you know, we're just wondering in general what it means that Trump has such high turnover with his trade staff, with his domestic and international staff in general, for his relationship with world leaders, especially when it comes to these trade negotiations.
Well, I think world leaders and their governments, their ministers, their trade ministers, never really know who they're going to be dealing with. So there's a lack of consistency in any organization when you have a lot of turnover, and especially in the United States government. And Trump himself sort of manages, according to the chaos theory, he is, as we've discussed, his policies are constantly changing, and also his personnel is constantly changing.
And speaking of themes, as Cheryl brought up, it does speak to this larger theme, not just among his trade staff or not just among his immediate White House staff, but all the acting secretaries that are across the agencies and the departments. It just shows how difficult it is for these positions to stay filled. And now we're probably going to have a bunch of acting secretaries going into the 2020 election.
Yeah, it raises the question of who wants to work for him.
And I think it should be mentioned this week also, a very significant story of Rex Tillerson, when he was Secretary of State, mm-hmm. having to discover by accident that the Mexican Foreign Secretary was in town. Profound breach of protocol, because he was having dinner with Jared Kushner in an administration where the son-in-law takes up so much of the decision making and doesn't follow the interagency process. You know, you're going to get a lot of acting secretaries because the bigger names are going to find it very, very hard to work in those conditions.
All right. Other White House news this week. Last Friday, New York Magazine published an excerpt of an upcoming book by E. Jean Carroll. In it, she says President Trump sexually assaulted her inside a dressing room at Bergdorf Goodman in 1996. The White House said, quote, "This is a completely false and unrealistic story surfacing 25 years after allegedly taking place and was created simply to make the president look bad." President Trump also added that Carroll was not his type. In an interview with The Hill, Laura, this is just the latest of many women who've accused President Trump of sexual assault. Why other men, other businessmen, political leaders might have fallen as a result? What makes Trump so resilient to these accusations?
I'm not sure what makes him so resilient. I mean, I guess it's that after the Access Hollywood tape came out in the 2016 election, and there was an immediate backlash from Republicans saying that he may not be fit to run for office. But after he won the presidency, Republicans have stopped pretty much pushing back on this. She is the 16th woman, I believe, to come forward with what look to be credible accusations of assault or rape. And it seems that there maybe are some GOP senators finally who appear as though they want to investigate some of these claims.
That's right. At least two. Mitt Romney, who frankly has never really been a big fan of Donald Trump, called for an investigation. And I think when you look at Mitt Romney, he is someone who is a devout Mormon. He prides himself on being a good family man. This kind of behavior would be abhorrent to him. And also, interestingly, Joni Ernst of Iowa. Joni Ernst disclosed earlier this year that she had been the victim of sexual assault. She's also running for re-election in Iowa, and so she is, I assume, mindful of female voters and Democrats who would expect her to stand up against this kind of behavior. But as to why Trump seems to be immune, you know, there's a phrase that has kind of grown up around the Trump presidency, and it's the Fifth Avenue Republican. And what the Fifth Avenue Republican means is President Trump once said, before he was president, "I could stand out in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and, you know, basically nothing would happen to me." And I think that that is actually true about him within the Republican Party. You know, he could pretty much do anything And we have not seen really any severe backlash against him within his own party. And those who have challenged him have been forced out, like Jeff Flake, who was the senator from Arizona, who concluded he couldn't win. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, also retired from the Senate. You know, they didn't like Trump, and they concluded that there was no place for them in the party with him in it.
So let's move over to Congress, where this week we learned that former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify before the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees next month on July 17th. Mueller has been reluctant to speak about his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. He spoke publicly for the first time last month and even said he didn't want to talk about it again. Nevertheless, he's coming up to the Hill. Edward, what can we expect from his testimony, do you think?
Well, he's clearly looking forward to this with all the anticipation of somebody going to the dentist for a lot of tooth extractions. He made very clear in his brief 10 or so minute statement last month that everything he wanted to say was in this 410-page report and that he had nothing further to add. And I think, you know, once the subpoena was presented, he agreed under those conditions he wouldn't defy a subpoena. The Democratic bet is that most people haven't read the report, and that hearing something televised, you know, primetime hearings is quite different to getting summaries and perhaps mis-summaries from the Attorney General, Bill Barr. The risk is that it falls flat, that those who are in favor of impeaching Trump, which the second half of Mueller's report lays out at least 10 instances of obstruction of justice, have lost a month in waiting for this. But that Nancy Pelosi, who doesn't believe that impeachment is the politically smart way to go, she's gained a month here, regardless of what happens in these back-to-back hearings on July the 17th.
So the subpoena brought Robert Mueller to Congress, but we're also following another subpoena from Congress. The House Oversight Committee has authorized one for White House counselor Kellyanne Conway after the White House blocked her from attending a hearing on her alleged violation of the Hatch Act. Laura, what is the Hatch Act, and what's next in this process for Kellyanne Conway?
Well, as it applies to Kellyanne Conway, this is about the fact that she has been talking about campaign and other business well on White House grounds, which usually are, if you're following norms and rules, you would not be doing.
If you're following the Hatch Act, you wouldn't be doing it because it precludes you from doing that.
And so, and she's violated it. It's not just that she's violated it once or twice. It has been a number of times. And so the advice that was given to the White House was that in a case like this, she would be fired. The subpoena, it was the authority was granted to, via the committee vote, to Cummings to issue a subpoena at any point, but there's no date for her to come forward that's been set.
So now we're going to hit the last branch of government while we still have a bit of time. A lot of news came out of the Supreme Court this week as the court wrapped up its term. On Thursday, SCOTUS ruled that the federal courts should not review the issue of partisan gerrymandering. Why was this issue up before the Supreme Court in the first place, and what did the majority decide?
Well, what the majority decided is that partisan gerrymandering is beyond their purview. John Roberts wrote the majority opinion, which I thought was very interesting, and he also wrote another big opinion, which you might want to talk about. But the court effectively said, this rests with the states. If states object to partisan gerrymandering, they will have to deal with it themselves, or Congress will have to deal with it. And really, it's a big win for Republicans, because Republicans control most of the state legislatures. The state legislatures write the district boundaries. So, you know, it's a good win for their party.
So the other decision that Cheryl was referencing, also on Thursday, the court ruled that the citizenship question will not appear on the 2020 census for now. Ed, what was the basis for this ruling?
Well, the court decided that, the majority decided that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who's in charge of the census, which is due to be, the forms are due to be printed on Monday, by the way, had provided very flimsy grounds for saying we've got to add this question, are you a U.S. citizen or not? He claimed that Wilbur Ross claimed that he'd been asked by the Department of Justice to supply this question because they wanted to protect the Voting Rights Act. And it became very clear very quickly that, and even John Roberts, the Chief Justice, said this, that Wilbur Ross had wanted to do this long before nudging the DOJ to ask that question. And what are the big issues here? It's The suspicion that the Trump administration wants to reduce the number of voters in Democratic areas, therefore, you know, reduce the representation of Democrats. It's all part of the larger voting and gerrymandering debate.
So what now on the census question?
Well, so what's left is that Trump said that he referred to his, quote, the lawyers, and is asking them, you know, if the census can be delayed. And then also, so that way they can get the necessary information to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court can make a final decision before they push out the census. But experts, you know, have warned that if this question were to be included on the census, they estimated that there could be an undercount of roughly 8 million people. So, you know, especially affecting states with high Hispanic populations and immigrant populations.
Before we go, let's take a moment to honor one of the original stars of public radio, Susan Stamberg.
I'm Susan Stamberg. I'm a special correspondent for National Public Radio. And my big break occurred essentially at the moment I made my radio debut. I was working at a local station in Washington, D.C. I was producing a daily program. And one day, the weather girl got sick.
That's right. Susan Stamberg has come far from her first break in radio as a daily producer right here at WAMU, the station that produces 1A. She's been selected as a Hollywood Walk of Fame honoree for 2020. Known as the founding mother of NPR, Stamberg's hosted each of NPR's news programs, including NPR's All Things Considered, for 14 years, and she launched Weekend Edition Sunday, where I used to be a producer. From one public radio journalist to another, Susan, keep shining. And a thanks to all my guests. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Luce is the chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His latest book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Thanks, Ed.
Always a pleasure.
And Laura Barone Lopez is a national political reporter for Politico. Great talking to you, Laura.
Thank you.
Let's go out on another LGBTQ anthem recommended by you. Marnix the Derg tweets, "The predatory wasp of the Palisades is out to get us" by Sufjan Stevens is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard, but it's also the first one I ever heard where a man directly sang about being in romantic love with another man. It's one of my favorite songs to this day. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai and Ben Privett. The digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the whole production crew, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dig into international news next. Stay close.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments.
This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. President Trump is in Japan for the annual G20 summit. He already met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and he'll meet Saturday with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. What's at stake in these talks? Protests in Honduras turn violent. Will that unrest lead to more people seeking asylum in the U.S.? And how was Jared Kushner's deal for Middle East peace received in Bahrain? Lots happened around the world this week. Let's take a look at some of the biggest stories that got us talking or that you may have missed. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup is Simon Marks. He's the president and chief correspondent for Feature Story News. Simon, welcome.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Jennifer Williams is also here. She's the foreign editor for Vox and co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi.
And Greg Myrie is a national security correspondent for NPR. He's also the co-author of This Burning Land: Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Good to have you, Greg.
Hey, Kimberly.
Journalist Julia LeDuc took a haunting photograph on Monday of a man and child face down in the Rio Grande River, drowned. That man was Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. He traveled with his daughter, Valeria, and his wife, Tania, to the U.S.-Mexico border from El Salvador. They planned to seek asylum in the United States. The photo and their story spread across social media this week and caught the attention of international leaders, including President Donald Trump.
There are times when going across the Rio Grande is very, very dangerous, depending on the time of year and the conditions and the rapidity of the water. And we know that. And we have many, many guards there. But people go through the guards.
Greg Myrie, I'll start with you. What does this moment tell us about the state of the immigration crisis?
Well, just how horrible it is to see images like this, and on top of the children that have been locked up, and nothing I think has galvanized or crystallized the crisis like this. And at the other end, just looking at numbers, you had 144,000 migrants taken into custody last month, the highest number in more than a decade. So both looking at it just as a hard-headed statistical issue and this incredibly shocking photo you saw, we have a big, big issue that's unresolved there. And we saw Congress pass a bill that may go to President Trump very soon for signing. So I think we're going to see some action finally based on these powerful images and this problem that just keeps getting worse seemingly.
Jennifer, Democrats blame the Trump administration's metering and wait in Mexico immigration policies. Can you tell us more about those?
Sure. So the father and daughter were basically part of this policy where instead of letting people cross over into the U.S. and then, you know, processing them and letting them stay in these temporary camps that the Border Patrol and ICE and everyone have set up, they kind of worked out an agreement with Mexico to essentially say, you guys stay on that side of the border until it's time for us to, you know, come in and have your hearings and things like that. And it's essentially trying to, you know, address the very real crisis that is happening on the border, right? There is a large number of migrants coming across the border into the U.S., and the U.S. is struggling to handle this, you know, adequately. Financially, they're running out of money. They're having to set up these temporary camps, which cost a lot more money to run and to set up than the, you know, the more long-term camps. And so that's where this man and his daughter were staying, was on the Mexico side of the border. But this camp, you know, where they were was, you know, running out of food. It was in, you know, 110 plus degree heat. And so, you know, essentially it was like, okay, well, I can stay here with my child who, you know, we don't have food, or I can try to just make it across the river, right? And I think it really shows the desperation that these people are dealing with and that are facing, right? If that's the best option you have is to, you know, try to ford a raging river just so that your child can eat, that's a stunning decision for any parent to have to make. And you see the tragic consequences, but you can only imagine what they were fleeing from and what the conditions must have been like for that to seem like a viable option.
The head of the Mexican army said this week that Mexico has deployed almost 15,000 soldiers and the National Guard in the north of the country to stem the flow of illegal immigration across the border. What progress, Simon, has the U.S. made with its partners like Mexico in stemming the flow of migrants north?
Well, look, President Trump keeps thanking the government of Mexico following those conversations that were held here in Washington a couple of weeks ago, the deal that they allegedly struck that saw the Mexican National Guard heading down to the country's border with Guatemala. He insists that that's going to make a difference to the flow of refugees trying to get into the United States. I think we have to wait and see just how serious an effort that is, both by the Mexican government, whether that's a substantial change in what they've been doing and whether it has a substantial impact on the flow. But I mean, this picture, I think it's important to underscore, this picture is as searing as far as the international consciousness is concerned as the heat in which Oscar Ramirez and his daughter died. And what is so stunning, particularly on the global stage, about the US government's reaction to it, you played a clip of Donald Trump there at the beginning of the program. At no point has the President of the United States or the government of the United States expressed basic sympathies or condolences to the Ramirez family. And indeed, last night on CNN, Ken Cuccinelli, the acting head of Citizenship and Immigration Services, blamed the father for what had happened. And that is a stunning point for any United States government to find itself. This picture that has been on the front pages of newspapers and websites globally, that has galvanized attention to what's taking place on the border, and the government can't even find the basic language to express sympathies and condolences to the families. It's an extraordinary moment.
And it's a bit in contrast, or quite a bit in contrast, to the reaction in El Salvador. The photo and the story, as you mentioned, Simon, didn't only capture the attention of America, it also resonated abroad. The president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, vowed to pay for the bodies of the father and daughter to be returned home, and he promised to help the family economically. Greg, can you talk a little bit about maybe how this is playing back in El Salvador?
Right. So he's a new president, just came into office, and he's inherited this very difficult situation, and he's trying to certainly be sympathetic, but it's he's encouraging his people not to leave the country, not to try to go north. It remains an open question whether he can do anything about that. The remittances that come back into the country really dwarf the aid. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the U.S. should do more, should help. You can certainly take your position on that. But the amounts that we've seen, even before it was cut by the Trump administration, was a small amount based compared to the remittances. So there's still an incentive, a desire for many Salvadorans to come here. And if you can make it here, you're more likely to be able to earn money to send back. So he's going to be fighting a tide of the violence and the trouble in the country that is still driving Salvadorans to leave. And so I think he's got a real uphill battle.
As well as what people are seeing in that family members who do leave are sending money home. And so it's a narrative to work against.
It's interesting looking at his Twitter messages this week. I mean, President Trump not being the only president who tweets. He said on Twitter, this is the president of El Salvador, "Someday we will finish building a country where migration is an option and not an obligation." I mean, that use of the word obligation is really reflective of his understanding of the view of many El Salvadorans that the situation in their own country simply does not allow them just to sit back and say, okay, well, we'll wait for this president or any other to finish creating prosperity in our own land. And I thought that was a very telling word that he chose to use there.
We have a tweet from Big Hempen who says, regarding Mexico sending its troops, 15,000 troops to fight migration, but not to fight drug cartels. What kind of resources, what is the resource demand being put on Mexico and other Central American countries as the United States continues to put pressure regarding the flow of migrants?
I think that's exactly the point, is that the resources are lacking. I think, you know, Mexico's government is and has been trying, making very serious, strong efforts to fight drug cartels, to fight the violence. You also have to understand that it's not just like you can go in and clean out a cartel's, you know, headquarters here. These people are executing journalists, executing local police, executing the people who are trying to clear out and to deal with this violence. And you have that kind of across, you know, Central America. And I think, you know, when we talk about U.S. aid to these countries, it's not just about dollar amounts, right? It's not just about humanitarian aid. It's also about security assistance. And that's one of the things that the U.S. traditionally did, was sending, you know, trainers and people there to help, you know, deal with the kind of more entrenched security problems. And trying to do that is another way that the U.S. could actually help address some of these systemic problems.
In El Salvador's neighbor to the northeast, Honduras, anti-government protests continue, with citizens taking to the streets to demand the resignation of President Juan Orlando Hernandez. This week, military police fired on protesters at a university in the country's capital, injuring at least four. This latest violence comes after weeks of deadly clashes. Greg, very quickly, why are they angry with the Hernandez leadership?
Well, it has to do apparently with health and some education reforms he's talked about, but also just the larger picture. Honduras, one of the most violent countries in the world in terms of the murder rate, along with other Central American countries. He's got strong support from the U.S., a conservative who's had the backing of the U.S., but I think there's just a lot of frustration there with the economic situation, and we've seen these clashes as part of the systemic problem there, and he's facing a lot of the challenges that are in Salvador and Guatemala as well.
Simon, let's start back up with you on this G20 meeting. President Trump is in Japan for the summit, which brings together world leaders. Trump met with Russian President Putin, and in a press conference afterwards, he appeared to make light of Russia's ongoing attempts to meddle in U.S. elections. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was an astonishing moment. As the two presidents met, there was a Russian government camera in the room that caught President Trump and Vladimir Putin shaking hands and introducing one another to their respective delegations. They made their basic remarks about the nature of the meeting that they were going to have. President Trump did not refer to election interference as an issue that was on his agenda, and so a reporter in the room shouted, "Are you going to raise the issue? Are you going to tell Vladimir Putin not to meddle in American elections?" And the president of the United States, with a smirk on his face, said yes and leant over to Vladimir Putin and said, "Don't interfere in the election," and then one more time said it again, "Don't interfere in the election." And there were chuckles all around the room, coming from, among others, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I mean, it was an astonishing moment, not the only astonishing moment in that interaction. The President of the United States suggested to Vladimir Putin that he had a problem with fake news, and of journalists, he said, "Get rid of them." He's talking to the president of Russia, who in his time in office has seen on his territory the murder of at least 38 journalists within Russia. It's an amazing position for an American president to be taking publicly with a Russian leader by whom he still appears to be very strangely beguiled.
We saw some of this coming a bit because before Trump left for Japan, the president was asked by reporters about what he plans to discuss with Putin, and this is what he said.
"I'll have a very good conversation with him. What I say to him is none of your business."
Jennifer, do we know anything concrete about what they discussed?
No, and we still don't actually know anything concrete about what they discussed last time they sat down and had a, you know, hour-plus long face-to-face conversation. And that's one of the very big problems, I think. You know, in this administration, you know, in past administrations, you used to get at least readouts, right? You used to get these kind of, they may not be super substantive, but they would at least give you the broad contours of what was discussed. And we have nothing. It's like a black box. They go in there, they discuss, they sometimes dismiss aides, and, you know, maybe just have one translator, which in of itself is not necessarily the best way to conduct diplomacy. So you don't know whose translator is translating what correctly. But I think that's part of the problem that we're seeing with the lack of kind of transparency toward Russia. And you would think that this president would understand that, yes, there has been this cloud of the Russia investigation over his presidency. And, you know, obviously we all know how he feels about that. But one would think that if, you know, you wanted to make the American people feel a little bit more confident in your stance toward Russia and your relationship with the Russian president, that you would maybe take some steps to try to, you know, build some confidence and make it, you know, clear that you're not doing anything untoward, that it's all, you know, diplomacy and it's all on the up and up. And he seems to have no bone in his body that indicates doing something like that. There's no kind of PR move to try to make it look like he's actually just being tough with Putin or anything. It's like he's just winking and nodding and joking along with Putin at this, you know, assault on American democracy. It's truly stunning.
And it doesn't have to be this way. Right. Theresa May of Britain met Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the G20 summit and did not engage in a nod and a wink and a chuckle, but told him very clearly to terminate what she described as Russia's destabilizing activity in the UK. This, of course, related to the nerve gas poisoning of the former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal. You know, the body language in that meeting was fundamentally different to the body language that we witnessed in the Trump-Putin meeting. And it doesn't have to be a nod and a wink and a chuckle, and you don't have to be driven to the point where you raise the issue of election interference, given that all your intelligence agencies are currently trying to figure out how to prevent it next year.
And to emphasize, all of the U.S. intelligence agencies have agreed that Russia is actively seeking to interfere in our elections. Another thing coming up, the G20. Greg, Trump advisors met with Chinese negotiators to discuss trade and the ongoing war over tariffs. Trump is scheduled to meet with China's President Xi Jinping on Saturday. Has anything significant come out of those meetings so far? And what should we look ahead to with that meeting?
Yeah, so nothing so far. Tomorrow's the meeting, as you said. And, you know, this sort of has been on hold for a little bit of the tariffs going essentially on Chinese imports from 10% to possibly 25%. And that would be a big hike. That would be significant.
This is just the latest round of tariffs on China.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, are they going to make some progress? Is this going to cool down? Or is it going to ratchet up? And I think these talks that the aides are having now and the meeting that Trump and Xi will have tomorrow are very, very significant. You know, they don't have much direct time together. So this is pretty important, and we'll see which way it's this is perhaps the most significant thing that will come out of the G20. Will the U.S. and China trade relationship look like it's improving and the tariffs and the friction cooling down, or is it going to ramp up?
Jennifer?
Yeah, there was some reporting shortly ahead of the G20 meeting that Xi Jinping was planning to make a kind of big ask of President Trump and basically say, look, if you want me to sign on to any kind of trade deal, you have to lift the ban on Huawei, right? This is Huawei has, you know, big Chinese technology company that is trying to basically sell its 5G infrastructure technology and other technologies to countries around the world, including European allies of the United States and in some cases in the United States itself. The United States intelligence community and security officials have basically said that could be potentially a threat, that the Chinese government could use these technologies as a backdoor to spy on the U.S. And other allies. And so in part because of that and in part because of the economic kind of incentive to, you know, have U.S. technologies be used over Chinese technologies, the Trump administration has placed this ban on Huawei. And Xi Jinping is very unhappy about this. And so it's essentially, according to reporting, going to make this ask and say, look, you lift this ban, you lift these tariffs, and then I'll sign into the deal. The problem is, if Trump were to agree to that, there's no, you know, guarantee that there will be any such trade deal, right? There's no guarantee. There's not going to be a paper deal that they send to Congress and ratify, right? It's kind of a handshake deal, if anything. Mm-hmm. So the fear is that, you know, the concern is that if Trump says, okay, sure, and gives up all of this leverage, then what happens? You know, do they just, you know, handshake and agree that we're absolutely going to play nicely together with trade? And then what happens if China doesn't?
So in addition to waiting to see what happens on trade, there's also a division among G20 nations over consensus over a joint statement. French President Emmanuel Macron has said he'd refuse to sign any statement coming out of this G20 meeting that failed to tackle climate change. Simon, how do you expect that to play out?
Well, that's going to be a big problem, isn't it? Because very clearly, the Trump administration is going to have grave concerns about the language that is used in any statement on the issue of climate change. Look, I mean, I think for a large number of the leaders attending that G20 summit, they've got fundamental questions about the nature of their relationship now with the United States. Is there any sense in which they share a common set of values with someone like President Trump, whether it's on the issue of climate change or if you're Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, whether it's on the issue of the mutual defense treaty that's been in place between the United States and Tokyo since the 1950s? Can they build some kind of relationship of trust with an administration that may find it very difficult to sign off on a closing statement that makes specific reference to climate change as a problem?
Greg, this is something that came up in the Democratic debates this week here in the U.S. about our relationship with our allies and the rest of the world moving forward. President Trump also met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel while he's at the G20 and weighed in on those debates. How does all of that play together?
Right. You saw the Democratic candidates, many of them saying, what's the first thing you would do in office? And they said it would be reestablish good relations with NATO or European countries, something that has been a given happen in American politics for decades, for generation, for leaders of both parties. So the Trump approach has clearly chipped away at these relationships. I mean, you know, he insulted Japan and saying Japan we'd have to go defend Japan if they were attacked, but they wouldn't have to come defend the United States. These allies that have been in place and alliances that have been in place for decades keep getting knocked. So it's having a real impact. And it was one of the few things that the Democrats wanted to talk about when it came to foreign policy. It was an issue they really didn't want to discuss in great detail, but they saw this as a real opening. We can rebuild those relationships.
NATO and going back into the Paris Climate Change Accord, yes, which a number of them cited as one of the first things they would do.
But is it really that easy, Jennifer? Just a new administration, if there is a new administration, could just reset everything that's changed?
I mean, no, I don't think they can reset everything just instantly. But I do think in a lot of ways that Europe is some ways waiting it out and, you know, essentially making plans for what to do once that guy is gone from the White House. You know, I do think there are, you know, decades-long bonds. There are, you know, close economic ties, close military ties. I think as much damage as, you know, Trump, the bull in a China shop, can do, I think there is a lot to still salvage. And I just wanted to make one quick point about Trump on climate change before we go on. He, you know, as we all know, has said multiple times he doesn't believe in, you know, human-caused climate change, called it a Chinese hoax. It's interesting, though, that his golf course in Ireland, he's actually working to build a seawall to mitigate explicitly against what his lawyers say is climate change. So even the president himself is actively taking steps to mitigate the effects of climate change, which I find a bit ironic.
We have an email from AS saying, in relation to President Trump's comments with Putin, none of your business? The president works for us. It's nothing but our business. Ice Flame tweets, one party takes election security seriously, and one party is completely compromised. And President Trump announced plans this week to place new sanctions on Iran in response to the shooting down of an American drone last week. The new sanctions would prevent some top Iranian officials from accessing the international financial system. These sanctions follow moves in April to stop nations from buying Iranian oil. Iran has responded in kind. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, said on Wednesday, as translated by his official website, quote, negotiation is an effort to deceive into doing what the U.S. desires. If you accept their request, you will suffer the worst things. And if you don't accept it, you will face the huff and puff and their hassles over human rights excuses, unquote. Jennifer, let's stay with you. How much do these sanctions hurt Iran?
So the sanctions that are already in place on Iran have been very, very devastating. The economy in Iran is already struggling before the sanctions ever came back on. But what's interesting about this latest rounds of sanctions is they actually explicitly targeted the supreme leader, which is something we haven't actually seen before. And in some ways, I think it could potentially be a positive move, in the sense that the supreme leader does have vast assets, and he does have his fingers in a lot of aspects of the Iranian economy, and in a lot of places that the average Iranian probably isn't aware of, that the supreme leader is so influential in some ways in controlling the economy. And, you know, if I'm the average Iranian and I see U.S. sanctions against me, and, you know, I can't get bread every day and I can't get access to basic staples, it's very easy to point to the United States and have the government, you know, make the United States the scapegoat fairly, right? Saying, well, they are sanctioning us, this is what's wrong. But, you know, if you bring light to the fact that the supreme leader has a vast amount of wealth, and many in Iran don't, I think that could potentially be a solid strategic move. But it also very clearly angered the Iranians. You know, they struck back and essentially said that the White House is intellectually disabled, let's say. They're less nice translations of that. But we're very angry by this move. But I think, you know, it's important to see that these lower level moves of sanctions and things like that in some ways can still be positive, in the sense that at least they're not bombs, right? At least they're not military strikes. And we saw, in addition to the sanctions on the Ayatollah, we also saw this cyber attack that the U.S. carried out against some IRGC, some Iranian kind of military assets that were used to launch missiles. So there are a lot of lower level things that are going on between the U.S. and Iran that I think aren't as visible, but that kind of
leave us in this kind of low-level simmering conflict that never really flares up into big war, hopefully. But it's still a very, very tense situation.
And Greg, is either side seeking to actively de-escalate at this point?
Well, not that we can see. Based on the rhetoric, it's still there. I think it is important to step back for a moment, though. Iran, as we've seen, can hit a U.S. drone. It could hit another U.S. aircraft in the Gulf. It could hit a U.S. ship. It could go after U.S. forces in the region. There are things Iran could do, but in terms of a major, sustained way, they really can't do it. Carry out, in effect, a war against the United States. It's really only the United States that could carry out a major sustained attack against Iran. So in that sense, the U.S. and President Trump control the dynamic in terms of if they're shooting or not, and can use options like sanctions and other measures to make a point without turning it into a shooting conflict.
The problem here, though, Greg, from an international perspective, is that there is absolutely no discernible cogent philosophy guiding U.S. decision-making on this issue. 8 days ago, John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, went home thinking that his pipe dream of a military strike against Iran was about to happen. It didn't. It gets called off by the President of the United States, who then says that he's engaged in a policy of restraint towards Iran. 24 hours after he says that, he's threatening parts of the country with obliteration. Now, Washington observers don't know what to make of any of this, much less Iranian ones. Imagine what's going through the minds of the Iranians as they try to understand if this is an administration seriously interested in talking or what the strategy is here.
And when asked about the possibility of striking a new deal with Iran on Wednesday, President Trump had this to say.
You know what? Iran can do whatever they want. It's just fine. I have plenty of time, but they have a country that's in economic distress. It's an economic disaster right now. They could solve it quickly or they can solve it in 10 years from now. Whatever they want is fine with me. In the meantime, they have very strong sanctions. They have to live with those sanctions, but Iran should do the right thing for their people. The problem is I'm not sure that their leaders care for their people. If they do, they'll make a deal. If they don't, they're just thinking about themselves. And they're selfish and they're stupid if that's what they're doing.
That was President Trump speaking to Reuters. We have a tweet from Kokomo Kid who says, "Why does Trump want to destabilize Iran and hurt the Iranian people? It will only make Iran lash out." Tensions between Washington and Tehran have been escalating throughout the week. Iran President Hassan Rouhani said Tuesday that the White House is, as Jennifer mentioned, afflicted by mental disability, unquote. To which Trump responded with that tweet that they're threatening overwhelming force and obliteration. Jennifer, let's start back with you. Business executives and Middle East diplomats met in Bahrain this week for a two-day Peace to Prosperity workshop. This was orchestrated by Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and leader of the administration's Middle East Peace Initiative. No Israeli or Palestinian leaders attended the summit, which focused on solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Did anything meaningful come out of this meeting?
Not particularly, no. So if you, just a step back, this is the economic piece of the plan, right, of this big deal of the century that Jared Kushner is supposedly negotiating with not the Palestinians, because they have been boycotting any involvement with the administration's peace efforts since the U.S. moved the embassy to Jerusalem and cut off aid to Palestinians and closed their offices in D.C. and a series of other moves. Essentially, the administration is trying to work out this grand peace settlement, right? And so they release this first half, which is the economic portion. And it has this all these kind of grand plans for infrastructure, for development, for things like property rights and contract law and very specific kind of economic reforms and investment opportunities. They're trying to draw something in like, you know, $50 billion eventually in investment into the West Bank and Gaza. The problem is, and it's a huge problem, is that the other half of the plan, the political plan, is missing. We don't have that. We don't know if it even exists. Potentially, the administration plans to release it sometime, maybe after the next Israeli election. But without that piece, all of these grand ideas about infrastructure and, you know, investing in building, you know, travel corridors to connect Gaza and the West Bank and, you know, having hospitals, you know, that have adequate care in Gaza, that all sounds amazing, right? That would be great. The problem is nobody is going to invest money in the West Bank in particular if Israel is continuing to do things like annexing sections of the West Bank. You're not going to invest in Palestinian infrastructure there. And conversely, in Gaza, nobody is going to invest. You know, there's an old saying, nobody invests money in a burning building, right? And you're not going to invest in, say, electricity infrastructure in Gaza if you know that the Israelis are potentially going to bomb the electricity infrastructure in Gaza in response to rocket attacks. So the problem is that without this political piece, without any kind of concept of even with whom you're negotiating, right? Even who does this investment go through? Does it go through Hamas, like the who governs Gaza in effect? You know, there's no actual structure there. So to start, you know, it's a novel idea, right? To start with the economic piece, it's a bold vision. But to start by saying that you're going to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with property rights and contract law is a bit audacious and a little bit disconnected from reality.
And that is most likely why Palestinian representatives who were at the summit were not happy with that economic proposal. And this relates, the role of Jared Kushner in all of this relates to something that came out in newly disclosed testimony, where former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Kushner operated independently with powerful leaders around the world without coordination with the State Department, leaving Tillerson out of the loop. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, this was testimony a few weeks ago that we had not previously seen, Rex Tillerson being questioned by members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And I mean, there's just one telling story hidden within this 140-odd page transcript of Rex Tillerson going to his favorite restaurant in Washington, D.C., and being informed to his surprise during the course of the meal by the maitre d' that the Mexican foreign minister is having dinner with Jared Kushner in a private room at the back of the restaurant, because the maitre d' assumes that Tillerson must know the Mexican foreign minister is in town and must know that he's in the restaurant. Well, Tillerson had no idea. Goes to the back of the room, walks in, says to the Mexican foreign minister, "Very nice to have you here. Next time you're coming to Washington, perhaps you'd like to let me know." But that message was clearly not just intended for the foreign minister. It was also intended for Jared Kushner. But this speaks to the absence of process, not just on the issue in that particular case of U.S.-Mexico policy. It speaks to the absence of basic government process when it comes to the waging of foreign policy by the Trump administration, which is why if you go back to, for example, the Iran issue, if you're the Iranians, you start realizing this is basically a one-man show. This is a Donald Trump show surrounded by Jared Kushner and maybe Ivanka Trump. And how do you deal with that?
But Greg, this is exactly what President Trump has articulated many times is the strategy that he wants. He wants different countries to be a little bit off base. He wants to know them to know that he is the one making the decisions, and he highlights that as one of his negotiating skills.
And there's certainly an advantage at times with not having your opponent know what you're thinking, what you're going to do next. It keeps them off balance. It keeps them guessing. But he's doing this with allies as well as rivals. And I think that's the real danger. If your allies don't know what you're going to do, if they don't know that the U.S. has your back, they may be looking elsewhere. And I think we've seen this with a lot of countries looking, hedging their bet, where they've depended or relied on the U.S. for decades, now sort of looking elsewhere. We don't know what we can expect from the administration. So it's a policy you probably don't want to overuse, number one, but you also want to direct it primarily at your rivals rather than your allies.
Tillerson is asked during the course of that testimony by a member of the committee if he can identify Donald Trump's values system. And he answers with one word, no.
All right, let's leave it there and move on to Europe. I'll actually stay with you, Simon, because in Prague, some 250,000 people gathered in protest early this week, according to local reports, to protest the leader there, Prime Minister Andrej Babiš. Babiš is currently under criminal investigation. What's the background?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. And I suppose when 200,000 people take to the streets of Prague, the world ought to pay attention. These are the largest protests since the Velvet Revolution back in 1989. By contrast, 750,000 people took to the streets of Prague then in order to get rid of the Soviet yoke. Andrej Babiš is a controversial prime minister of the Czech Czech Republic. He is accused of misusing European Union subsidies through a company in which he was involved by the name of Agrofert to build a farm and a conference center. And the police in the Czech Republic have recommended that he should face fraud charges. Now, fraud charges can only be brought on the basis of the recommendation of the justice minister. And so he now finds himself being accused of removing one justice minister and appointing another who is politically loyal to him and seen as less likely to bring those fraud charges against him. And that is fermenting this kind of unrest against his government. The interesting thing about this is that the protesters are not just marching with Czech flags, they are marching with flags of the European Union. Hmm. And the European Union is seen by many of these demonstrators as the kind of beacon that can bring about the sort of regularity to a democracy, that can underpin a democracy and help them stop what they see as this kind of unfair behavior by the Prime Minister. We'll have to see, you know, where this all leads, but it's a big deal.
Is there any indication of where it's going to lead?
Well, I think we have to see how much more intent the protest movement is in terms of taking to the streets. But if you look at not just the history of Prague in 1989 and the Velvet Revolution, but the history of Prague in 1968 and the uprising against the Soviet Union at that point, look, the Czech people are not hesitant to get out on the streets, which is why Soviet tanks at one point were rolling through the streets of that absolutely gorgeous city. So let's see.
Jennifer, some UK news. Boris Johnson is leading the Tory party in the UK and blazing. That was a heavy sigh.
Yeah.
Two of them.
And he's blazing a path to become prime minister. He's been shrugging off a troubling story regarding a domestic dispute. What's happening there?
Right. So there was this basically there were loud noises coming from his flat, I guess you Brits call it, from his home, screaming, shouting, sounds of glass, sounds like plates breaking. The neighbors essentially woke up out of, you know, the middle of the night and heard this, what sounded like a pretty raucous domestic dispute, overheard, you know, things like, you know, get out of my flat. Give me back my laptop.
Get off me.
Yes, get off me, which is one of the most disturbing ones. You know, it's a flat that Boris shares with his, you know, longtime girlfriend. So they called the police. The neighbors called the police. Not 911. What is it? 999. Yes. And, you know, it was investigated. And it's still not really clear what was going on, which is the problem. But, you know, the fact that one of the most prominent politicians right now in the UK, who, to be honest, you know, is not already seen as the most, let's say, stable gentleman, and has some erratic behavior, some erratic tendencies. You know, one of the biggest concerns in terms of, you know, will he actually get the support of more conservatives in the party is that he is seen as a bit of a gamble, right? Will he be able to get himself together? Will he be able to conduct himself in a way that is befitting a prime minister potentially? And this sort of thing doesn't necessarily lend itself to building up that kind of credibility.
So he's in a two-man race against the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt to succeed Theresa May, not just as Conservative Party leader, but therefore as Prime Minister. It is generally agreed the only person who can stop Boris Johnson from becoming the next Prime Minister is Boris Johnson. He didn't totally derail his campaign last week. Let's see what the future days bring.
And Greg, staying in Europe, Europe is facing an intense heat wave. I mean, it's hot here in D.C., but this is something else. It's record-breaking temperatures. Some of the effects are including a 10,000-acre wildfire in Catalonia, Spain, and France seeing temperatures at their highest since a 2003 heat wave, which claimed the lives of 15,000 people. How severe is this heat wave, and what do these countries have to even do to support their people through this?
Right. Record temperatures, 111 degrees in the south of France, for example, and across Germany and Poland, Czech Republic, all recording record highs. And of course, this raises a speculation. Is this just a temporary blip in a particularly hot summer? Is this related to climate change? And those are perhaps somewhat challenging questions to answer in just a specific case. But still, you know, we're seeing these terrible fires and real problems that we just these countries aren't used to dealing with, and it's going to be long, hot summer, it looks like.
Yeah, I think that the point you just made that they're not used to dealing with is really the crux of the problem. It's that, you know, in places like I'm from Texas, right? So in places like Texas, we have the infrastructure built to deal with high temperatures, right? Because we're used to that. If you go to places like the Gulf, you know, Saudi Arabia, there is infrastructure like air conditionings in every building. But, you know, when you go to other places that don't typically have on a regular basis these high temperatures, you don't have things like a lot of places that have air conditioning. You don't have, you know, people who are used to how to dress, how, you know, what hours to avoid being out in the sun. And so because of that, you have people going about their daily lives as usual and then being, you know, stricken by this horrific heat wave, especially, you know, younger people, the elderly, pets, animals at the zoo. There were these, you know, really moving but also disturbing photos of, the, you know, zookeepers giving polar bears like these frozen ice treats to try to keep them at least cooled down. And you can only imagine, you know, how it must be for elderly people and for young people and for everyone else.
Last week, a meteorologist in France displayed a weather map with heat patterns across the country, and it looked like a famous painting by Edvard Munch from 1893 called The Scream, and he sort of juxtaposed those two images next to each other to sort of relate how people were processing the weather. Let's move over, Greg, if we can, to talk about a story out of Africa. 37 people were killed during an attack Sunday in Ethiopia's Benshangul-Guma region. The attack happened not far from the Amhara region, where authorities stopped an attempted coup of the regional government on Saturday. Three officials, including the region's president, were killed. In Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, the military's chief of staff was also killed by a bodyguard in the hours following the attack in Amhara. Access to the internet, which has been blocked since Saturday, was restored on Thursday. At least 250 people have been arrested. What is going on here?
So this was a little surprising because we've had some pretty positive news coming out of Ethiopia for the past year or so. The prime minister there, Abiy Ahmed, has introduced a package of economic and some political reforms, freeing people considered political prisoners, giving journalists more freedom, opposition parties. So the international community has applauded the things he's done. He's improved relations with the neighboring country of Eritrea, where there's been a tension for many, many years. So we'd seen all these sort of positive developments, and it looked like Ethiopia might be turning a corner. But this apparent attempted coup, which came from within the security forces, was very disturbing. And again, when you start shaking up a country, and particularly a country like Ethiopia, which has a lot of different ethnic and tribal groups, there are winners and there are losers. Certain groups that feel they've lost out, and others are feel they're finally gaining. So there's a lot of tensions as he makes these changes. And after a year of everything you're hearing sounding like Ethiopia might be moving in the right direction, this sort of unsettling coup attempt, which seems to be under control for the moment, but raises the prospect that there's more tension there.
We're running low on time there, but I did want to bring up this. Public radio listeners have a reputation for being truth seekers who love farmers markets and tote bags. We're not really known for being rule breakers. So many of you might identify with the bucket list item of 93-year-old Josie Birds, who lives in Greater Manchester in the United Kingdom. According to a tweet from her granddaughter, Birds, who is in ailing health, had been, quote, good all her life and wanted to be arrested as her dying wish. The Greater Manchester Police complied, placing her in handcuffs and taking her to the police station, where she was questioned rigorously before being offered tea and cake.
Oh, bless her heart.
Always tea and cake.
Well, thanks to all my guests this Friday. Simon Marks is president and chief correspondent of Feature Story News. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Jennifer Williams is Vox's foreign editor. Great talking to you, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
And Greg Myrie is a national security correspondent for NPR. Have a great weekend, Greg.
My pleasure.
1A's senior team includes Danielle Knight, Denise Couture, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. The show is edited by Miranda Fulmore. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. Thanks so much for listening. Have a nice weekend, everybody. This is 1A.